we're somewhere on the sectional chart. We haven't given away where yet. People are probably screaming at their screens, where are we? And so I want to throw it to the roundtable, who also doesn't know, other than Wally, where we are. What are your guesses? Does anybody have a guess for where we are here?
If I could open the window and smell the throat rolls, I would know that I was in Sykeston, and that would confirm my position. I think it's south of Cairo, south of the west.
Okay, I see it. Yeah, so we're not in Sykeston. That's a good guess, though. Anybody else?
I guess Sykeston too.
All right, Wally, why don't you tell us, where are we and how could people have figured it out?
I don't have the map in front of me. It starts with an A.
Anna. So there's a couple things that are sort of giveaways here. I mean, the town itself, you can, if you know that it's Anna, you can figure it out. It makes sense when you look at the orientation of the roads and railroads and things like that. But there are a lot of towns that are like that.
Is it east of the Mississippi?
Yeah. It's due north of Cairo, about maybe 25 miles north of Cairo up the road.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I see it. Okay. Yeah.
So anyway, there are those defining features, but they don't really help you discriminate between it and the other towns, which also a lot of them have roads and railroads. But they're
it's the cross. Yeah, I just looked at the map now.
Yeah, if you look to the northwest, so your rear left window here, there's a white. Well, it's a cross on a hill. It's actually a cross. And if you look at the sectional, there's a cross. It just says cross. So that's the giveaway. There's also a quarry on the north side of Anna that you can see in the pictures that might help you narrow it down. There are a few quarries on the sectional, but
that's pretty skinny information. I don't want anybody to think that I figured this out. Jeff and Ryan told me. So
no, it's tough to figure out the specific spot unless you happen to spot that cross and get really lucky. But Wally, you don't even make an effort in your response really to figure out where we are. And some people, if they use the C's, whether they're the four C's or the five C's for lost procedures, have a C that's circle for that reason exactly. Just stay over the town, don't get more lost, and head off in some direction when you don't know where you're going. Figure out where you are first. And so why not? Why not hang out there and figure out exactly where we are before making your next move?
First of all, I'm getting low on fuel. I'm running out of options here, and I'd prefer to find an airport. Sure, I can land in a field with this cub pretty easily. But I'd just rather not do that. It's pretty obvious to me there's no airport at this town. So I'd rather spend my time and my fuel available moving on to the next town in hopes that there'll be an airport there. Eventually, I'm going to get low enough on fuel that I'll have to land anyway. But low light situation, the colors are it's hard to distinguish when you're in an overcast situation with a little snow on the ground covering some landmarks. And frankly, I just don't see any reason to stay here unless I intend to find a field and land here, and I should have enough fuel to get to a couple of more towns, so I think my odds are better getting to an airport.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, your actual answer, if you were actually in the situation, is to start using the modern tools again. Get on the radio, get on the GPS on your phone or your iPad or whatever. Know where you are and give up on the game at this point. So I want to go back to the beginning. Both the beginning of this entire trip and the beginning of this flight. Let's start with the beginning of this entire trip and say, was this ever a good idea to begin with? Paul?
You know, it's a little like practicing bleeding because, we developed all this technology for a reason. And we use it and it has materially, substantially improved safety. Having said that, I don't think it's wild-eyed crazy to attempt something like this, but I would point out that when she did the her trip, the accident rate was something like 30 fatalities per 100,000 hours. Now it's under one, so, and there are a lot of reasons for that. We don't have to belabor them, but so if you go out and do this, I think you have to establish a threshold and stack the cards in your favor so that if you get lost in this circumstance and you're not comfortable landing in a field, I would be. I would land, find out where the hell I am if I couldn't otherwise figure it out. Then I think you have to resort to the technology in the name of safety and don't feel it's some kind of shame. I mean, just doing the trip dragging the airplane that far is an accomplishment.
Dave.
Yeah, if we're going back to the beginning, let's go back to B. And B was using the best technology of her day. And I think she would think you were a total fool and be disappointed in you. She would be very disappointed in you for your decision to forego all the advancements that have happened since then. And, you know, if she had, I just go back to her situation and you'd think, all right, what would she have given for an iPad and ForeFlight or ADS-B in her day? It would have simplified her life tremendously. And in this situation, I'm going to confess. I have no trouble confessing that I'm lost. And I think that I would just sort of look outside, try to find the best weather, fly for as long as I feel comfortable in, you know, in the best weather conditions I can find, and then do what she would have done in her day, which is land in a pasture. And if you can find an airfield, great. You know, I would love that too. But if not, you just fly east toward your ultimate destination. Fortunately, you're in an area that's flat, has lots of open fields, has lots of ag strips. You know, I would think that in the solid hour that you've got remaining with fuel, you know, your odds of finding a really safe place to land or an ag strip are excellent. And I would do that. You know, flashing back to 1949 and B, I would think she would be really disappointed in you for not bringing the tools that you have available, because had she had them available, I would think that that she would be all about using them.
Yeah, it's fairly flat terrain, but if you back up along the path that we probably took here, you either went through a Class Delta airspace, or if you were a little bit north of that, you went through this forest of towers that are 1500, 1600 feet tall.
And that's
right when the visibility was low.
Right. And that's a real drawback to following roads at low elevation, is that that's where the cell towers are, you know, especially highways. You know, highways are pockmarked with towers and obstacles for low level. You know, they can snare a low level airplane. So, you know, one thing, if you're thinking about following the roads, you know, lots of pilots have come to grief following roads because of the obstacles that are put by them.
Yeah, and Grandma B probably would have loved to have those cell towers on her iPad, right?
Yeah.
Bruce.
There is a middle ground here. If you want to recreate one of these experiences, or what I do with private pilots when we're doing cross-country, VFR cross-country exercises, is, you know, just turn off the own ship display on your iPad with ForeFlight. And if you're flying an airplane like a G1000 airplane, put the traffic view up, the traffic page up. You get no useful navigation information. Now you can practice your pilotage or pretend that you're flying in 1949. But if you need it for any reason, you have an emergency or you get lost, then you immediately have the information available. The GPS has been keeping track of your position in the background and so forth. So, you know, it's not an all or nothing proposition here. You can still practice these valuable skills and sharpen your pilotage and dead reckoning skills, but have that backup available to you. And I'm 100% with Dave on this. You know, if you look at the accident statistics, you know, we don't get lost anymore. You know, we have fewer controlled flight into terrain accidents because we know where we are. We have tools like obstacles and so forth available to us, obstacle databases and terrain databases. So, you know, when I go to the doctor, I don't say, you know, just for the hell of it, let's treat me like it was, 1950, you know, when you got your training, you know, use the tools you would have had available then. I want all the available knowledge and tools to be treated properly.
So you say, though, that these are valuable skills to work on, to have at some point, but we're talking, you know, pilotage, dead reckoning, lost procedures. You say we never get lost anymore. What is it actually that makes these skills valuable? Best answer gets a brand new E6B.
Well, it's really the old situational awareness. You know, staying alert to where you are, what's going on around you, and always asking the what if question. That's why it's valuable.
And you can always get out the leeches for some bloodletting, Bruce. That's your point.
Leeches. But, here we go.
And I would draw your attention to an article that Bruce wrote about flight training, and a sort of heartbreaking situation in which a 170 got destroyed while the CFI was teaching pilotage and dead reckoning. And, you know, they flew up basically a box canyon, isn't that right? When they destroyed the airplane.
Yeah.
You know, for looking back on it for no good reason. Bruce, you care to elaborate?
Yeah, it was actually a flight instructor with a student. They were doing a mountain cross-country flight in a 172 with round dials, but they took off and got disoriented. There was smoke in the skies. It was summertime. We had a lot of, you know, forest fire smoke. So they got disoriented. Used that confirmation bias kicked in. They thought they were at one place. They were pretty convinced of it. They turned and ended up flying up a canyon they couldn't get out of. Fortunately, the flight instructor, an experienced flight instructor, said, look, we're not getting out of this. We're going to land under control in the trees. We're not going to try to turn around. And that's what saved them. But the airplane was destroyed. They got out with just some scrapes. But yeah, if they had been using their GPS or had it available to them, readily available to them, they could have avoided this whole problem.
Tom?
Yeah, I just want to go back to the beginning again, where, you know, this is kind of a romantic notion, a nostalgic kind of thing to follow this route with grandma, document it, that kind of thing. Nothing wrong with that. However, grandma got to be a grandma, live long enough to be a grandma, because she may practice some smart level of weather decision making and sort of general flight planning, even given the tools that she had. So if she would even have left on a day where the forecast was this, given what she had, or once she got into the flight and began having the low visibility conditions, hopefully her weather decision making would have told her that she should either land now or turn around and go back. In this case, this guy didn't. He continued on into really pretty miserable conditions. And if I were he in this case, I chose three, because I'm not going to abandon the railroad. You know, it's IFRR, I follow railroads. And so that's the reason that I chose three, is that I'm not going to go back hoping to find the river turning one direction or another. I've got the railroad. I'm sure that it's going to lead me to a town. And I've got some fuel left. So I'm going to follow the railroad a while longer and see if I can't find a town with an airport and land. And at this point, I'm kind of giving up on the whole scenario. But at some point, I would also be whipping out the GPS, you know, maybe not yet, because I still have a decent amount of fuel left, but I'm going to be relying on the technology to get me out of a bad situation and not take this to a crazy extreme.
Yeah, and we've got four on Team Wally here following the railroad south, and all of you would have ended up, you know, maybe slightly by accident, but at Cairo, the intended destination. If you had turned and gone north up the railroad, you would have also found an airport. You would have got to Carbondale, Southern Illinois. It's a Class D airport, but it's straight up the road, about the same distance as Cairo. If you thought you were still east of the river, or sorry, if you thought you were still west of the river and headed east, it'd be a while before you ran into something. And that's Team Paul and Dave here. So what's your justification for going east? Is it just that there's no way we could have missed the river? Paul?
Yeah. I mean, the Mississippi, yeah. Right? I mean, you've flown across, all of us have flown across the Mississippi here, you know, in a high performance single, you know, you'll see it. In a Cub, it's like a cross country across the Mississippi. It's slow. You're going to see it. It'll be there. It'll be there for a long time. So not to beat up on this guy, but if your skills are such, and your observational capabilities are such that you miss the Mississippi, then you're going to have real problems completing this trip. So I thought it most likely that he didn't miss Mississippi, and then I'm going to go east. And I would go east to the point where I had maybe a half hour fuel. And if I didn't have anything in sight, I'd pick a field and land. I mean, that's all flat area. It's November, so the corn's been harvested. And lots of places to land. I'd find a wide spot or a town and land and find out where the hell I am and borrow a car and go get some gas.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair strategy. And we, you know, we set it up so the drop in visibility happened right as you were crossing the Mississippi. The pilot was busy and distracted and not very observant, apparently.
But I'd also broken out the GPS right before this. I mean, I agree with everybody else, with Dave. It's ridiculous not to use these tools just to prove a point. You're already proving a pretty good point. You're hauling this airplane across the country. Like, like Grandma did.
Well, the other reason that you're... I'm sorry, Dave, did you have anything to add there?
I was just going to say that Grandma B probably had the experience of landing in a pasture off field as a precautionary landing, and that would have been part of flight training in her day.
Yeah, a good chance it happened multiple times on this trip that you're recreating, I would guess. Steve?
And Tom's paying attention to the documentary filmmaker element of this. That would actually be a thing that could, in all likelihood, in this aircraft or on that terrain, been a thing that could have been done safely. I look at this as the thing that I'm paying most attention to. I do care where I am and how to get to, you know, an actual chartered airport to put the aircraft down. The thing that is more on my mind is the time uncertainty of, I don't know that the viz isn't going to drop and force my hand, especially this time of year in that region. You might not, you know, the weather isn't always a thing ahead of you that you can backtrack. The weather can, especially this kind of stuff, come down all around you. Now you're in a forced situation. I think I'm with Paul in terms of, you know, if we had, what, an hour and a half of gas left, I'm not ready to break out the GPS just yet. But I think going much further, or if there's any substantial chance that visibility is going to come down and put you, you know, IMC or down below the level of the towers in a Cub, I think at that point, or certainly 10, 15 minutes before that, GPS is coming out and stuff just got real, and you make of it what you can for the documentary. I'm much more about, this is a time thing, not just for the gas, but for the visibility that could turn this into more than even a force landing, but a situation where you're unable to keep the airplane right side up.
Yeah, you've done some documentary filmmaking in airplanes, Steve. And that's one of the other reasons that this pilot, other than just, you know, recreating history and ego of not wanting to give up on the mission, that's like, this is going to be good content, right? This is going to be a good video.
Trying to get in the head of a documentary filmmaker making what is to this pilot filmmaker a really important story, I'm willing to let him, the pilot, go a little further with the understanding that I'm going to turn into Paul very rapidly if I think there's any chance that viz is going to come down. I've got precip, or I end up in a situation where, I mean, best find airport. Next best, land under power in a pasture. Great for the story. Worst thing is this thing runs into enough time, distance, and whatever where we're suddenly in the precip and the airplane's upside down. Now we're talking about a completely different result that is, you know, even if you care about it from the standpoint of a documentary filmmaker, you're not going to have much of a documentary because, you know, nobody's going to buy, watch, or otherwise patronize a film that ends that way.
Yeah. But the drama of pushing on an unknown location, unknown weather, I mean, that's a real pressure here. I think a lot of us hook up cameras to our planes and fly. How about Bruce? I mean, I know you always have cameras running on your Bonanza. Does it change your, does it change your approach at all when you know the cameras are rolling? How do you make sure that it doesn't affect safety?
Well, I certainly don't do anything in the airplane just because the camera's going that I wouldn't otherwise do. I mean, I'm not filming real. I mean, I'm not transmitting in real time, so I have the option of not posting a video that shows me doing something stupid or getting into a situation that I shouldn't have gotten into. You know, I'm not like some of the YouTubers you see out there who you sort of wonder, why did they put that up? But
your SD card will end up being thrown free of the fire.
Yeah. But that is a good point. I mean, even NTSB has weighed in on this, you know, that don't do stuff to, you know, because you've got a camera going or you otherwise, you know, want to have a presence on the internet.
But even just talking to the camera as you fly, I mean, there's a lot of low time right. private pilots, even student pilots filming their first solos and narrating to the camera as they do it. Like, you know, CFIs know how to talk and fly for the most part, but but it is a distraction.
Yeah.
Wally.
I just want to go back to to the fact that pilotage is still a basic skill that we all need to have as pilots. And of course, it's easy to get by without it nowadays with that magenta line out there to follow and a moving map that shows us where we are. But it's worthwhile practicing, I think, because as we pointed out in the response, sometimes those things fail. But it's also just fun to look down there and see the towns and rivers and find them. And the other advantage is when one of your passengers asks you, what's the name of that town? You won't have to make up a story. at the airline, often we'd be flying along somewhere out west, far out west, and the flight attendant would say, someone wants to know what the name of that lake is. There's a lot of, about 1,000 giant reservoirs up there. So I just had a standard answer. It was always the Grand Lake. And that handled it. But you might actually have a passenger that has a map with them, or nowadays on the airline, the people probably all have their ForeFlight going. It's worthwhile to stay proficient, and not to mention that it's also a requirement to pass a flight test.
Right. Yeah. I do want to go back to that because I think I learned to fly. I got my license in 2004 in 152s. So, just pre-iPad, and we did everything pilotage and dead reckoning and then instrument training right after that was pre-iPad and in some cases pre-GPS, and I know all of you learned prior to that too, but I feel grateful to have learned all that stuff first, but it's sometimes hard to put my finger on why exactly. Paul.
I agree with you. You know, Wally, I agree with you, but I don't know why, and I don't really have any commitment to it, because we teach people pilotage skills and dead reckoning and all of that, and we fully know they will never use it. Very few of them will ever use it. Map reading skills and all of that stuff. And we continue to say, well, you know, we think they should have this. But we all admit, I think, if we're honest, that, well, you know, that they don't use it and they are unlikely to ever use it. Because, I mean, if you go back to before maps became common, you know, people crossed the West on the Oregon Trail. They didn't have any maps. Mm-hmm. They just followed the grooves. And so it's a little bit like that. I mean, we give them these really old school tools, but they're not using that. They're using modern age tools that are much better, much more accurate, and pretty reliable. So at some point, I think we're all going to have to admit that we can't spend as much time as we do on paper navigation and charts and so forth, just because we think they should have it.
Yeah, I know. To me, it's something like there's a background process that's always going on once you've learned that stuff that sort of sanity checks what the gizmos are showing you, you know, because it's easy to say, like, you've got that stuff as a backup in case things fail. But like you said, Paul, that doesn't happen that often. But I want to...
Because there's a time coming when we won't have paper charts. They'll stop producing them. And that time is in sight.
Yeah. And Bruce, I want to go to you because I know that your teaching philosophy often starts with the tech.
Well, what we do, what I advocate and have been pushing with our flight instructors at the flight school where I teach is, you know, I want to make sure that our private pilot students, let's just stick there for a moment, we know that when they go out in the real world, they're going to be using an iPad with ForeFlight or something. So, for example, when I do a stage check for a cross country where the navigation's a thing, I ask them to produce a standard nav log, and then I ask them to take me through one or two lines of that nav log and explain to me where all those numbers come from. Do they know what a true course is and so forth? But I know nobody, I certainly don't in my flying, you know, I'm not calculating wind correction angles, you know, for every leg of my flight, right? That would be silly. On the other hand, when we get in the airplane or even in the sim, we do what I discussed earlier, which is let's turn off your own ship display. That essentially turns your ForeFlight into a paper chart. It's just a map that you have to keep up with. You know, if you're flying an airplane with a big moving map, put the MFD page onto like traffic. It still gives you useful information should somebody be intruding on you, but it gives you no navigation help. And then really help impress, particularly new pilots, how do you even know what an airport looks like from 3,500 feet? They don't. So they get an idea of, oh, these are the signs I can look for an airport. Or in this case, in this scenario, you know, there's a lake there that might have been a good landmark. But this is winter. It could be covered with snow or ice, and it wouldn't look anything like the lake on the chart. So these are all useful lessons. And I have found in my flying, you know, out in the Seattle area, it's pretty hard to get lost. I just recently did a trip all the way down to Las Vegas and back, and I could just keep the mountains on one side going south and on the other side going north, and it was pretty hard to get really lost. But I have flown across South Dakota and Iowa and Illinois, and you're out there over this grid, and for someone who's not familiar with the area, it can be very confusing. And so having backup, learning how to use all the available resources to confirm your position, not get trapped by confirmation bias, is really important.
Yeah, a friend of mine on one of his first solo cross countries in Minnesota took off and flew exactly the wrong direction for about 50 miles, just convincing himself, yep, that's the town, that's the lake. It took that long. Dave.
No, I recently had the experience of getting out a paper chart, you know, VFR sectional and using it. And, you know, Paul's right that it's like these things aren't going to be printed probably that much longer anymore. But it's like I was really struck by the fact that, wow, this map is really beautiful. I mean, it's really well done. It's, you know, it's intricate. It's a piece of art. And, you know, and there's an art into using them and incorporating them in your flying too. And just the tactile sense of getting that paper chart out, looking at it in great detail, planning. I'm just saying it was a surprisingly enjoyable experience. The tactile sense of getting out this paper chart, folding it, drawing a line, looking at the, you know, envisioning in your mind's eye, the things you'll be seeing when you come to certain points along the trip. And it's like something is definitely going to be lost when those paper charts and the experience of flight planning with paper charts goes away.
Yeah. Yeah. No, sectionals are pretty cool. You know, I mean, maybe this wasn't a good plan from the beginning. Maybe this leg in particular wasn't a good idea unless we were prepared to give up on 1949 strategy at the first sign of trouble. But I think, you know, I get the sense from this conversation that that putting away the tech every once in a while with a good backup plan in place, always able to turn it back on if you need it, and it keeps you more engaged in the flight, and it sort of builds that background process that runs on every flight. It's also just a lot of fun sometimes.